This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. 50 years ago, almost a quarter of North Carolina's population was living in poverty. Many urban neighborhoods still had dirt roads. Many houses lacked running water and indoor plumbing. Governor Terry Sanford found that it was time to get creative about eradicating poverty, urban and rural, all across the state. So he created the North Carolina Fund. The fund was a way to sponsor local organizing initiatives in poor communities across the state, particularly by getting poor people across racial lines directly involved. 50 years later, we reflect on the legacy of the North Carolina Fund. Howard Fuller and Ruby Gaddis were both organizers with that fund. Howard Fuller is now a professor of education at Marquette University. Welcome back, Howard Fuller. Good to have you here.
Good to be back again. I appreciate it.
And Ruby Gaddis, community organizer based in Durham. Welcome to you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Bob Korstad. Bob's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. He, along with Jim Laloudis, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, wrote the book To Right These Wrongs, The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. Bob Korstad is here. Welcome back, Bob. Good
to
have you here.
Nice to be here, Frank.
Set the scene for us. Tell us about the political and economic climate in the early 60s in North Carolina.
Yeah, the economic climate was pretty dire in the early 1960s. There had been a pretty major transformation in agriculture, mechanization. So there were a lot of unemployment, a lot of underemployment, racial discrimination had really impeded economic development in the state. And the educational system was really in dire straits. I mean, half the students were dropping out of school. As you said, the poverty rate was around 25%, high unemployment. So it was a really challenging moment, I think, when Terry Sanford became governor, and in 1963 when he created the fund.
You know, it's interesting, not unlike the challenges that were faced by many southern states. And at the very time you have Alabama's George Wallace saying segregation then, segregation now, and segregation forever, Terry Sanford is making speeches about ending segregation and about how we move forward as a state. And economic development and ending poverty seem to be important to him, not so much to other governors. How much of an outlier was he in this state?
Well, he was very much of an outlier, particularly by 1963 when you're talking about George Wallace. I think Terry, along with a number of other leaders in North Carolina, when they came back from the war, had decided that they wanted North Carolina to become part of the nation. They wanted it to become a prosperous partner. And the only way they were going to be able to do that was to prod economic development, social transformation. And I think a lot of other southern governors were more concerned with their political positions and maintaining segregation.
And it's interesting that he saw those things as linked, that you couldn't possibly move into the 20th century, join the rest of the economic development in the rest of the country, unless you ended segregation and addressed poverty directly.
Right, that's right. And I think he saw that in part as he was promoting educational reform, and he was out visiting in black schools and telling them, you get a good education, you can go anywhere, and all of a sudden realize, well, no, that's not the case.
All right, so how does he get this? Tell us about the North Carolina Fund and how he gets that funded.
Yeah. Well, as he had found in funding his education program, the General Assembly was very conservative those days, and he knew they weren't going to provide the tax money to create some kind of poverty program. And so he, in a way, kind of did an end run around them by going to the Ford Foundation, Z. Smith Reynolds, and Mary Reynolds Babcock, and ultimately the federal government after Johnson's War on Poverty started. So it was a very clever design to create this kind of public-private enterprise that would address these issues.
Because he did it very publicly. He wasn't surprising anybody. He just didn't go through the legislature. So talk about your involvement. Ruby Gaddis, tell us about your involvement in the North Carolina Fund. What were you doing?
My involvement was with the neighborhoods, being a part of one of the poverty area neighborhoods. We developed a United Organization for Community Improvement, which included representation from all of the neighborhood councils in the Durham and Durham County area.
And let me forgive me for interrupting, but I want to know how you got involved in this. Had you been an activist or an organizer before?
Not before, no. How I got involved was a little group called Coffee Talk in Action. They were canvassing neighborhoods and telling people about Operation Breakthrough and what it was in Durham to do. And we started a little neighborhood group with a little group called Children's House, a daycare center for students, mm-hmm. little children in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And the parents group at the Children's House became our neighborhood council. And through working with them, we got involved with Breakthrough and then just moved on from there. I started out as just a parent working in the neighborhood.
Just a parent. Having raised two, that's no small order. And yet you move on to help the entire community. Howard Fuller, what was your involvement? Tell us.
Well, you know, when I came to North Carolina on, it was either May 3rd or May 5th. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, in 1965, and I actually came to Durham to work for Operation Breakthrough. Breakthrough was one of the community action programs. As Bob said, the North Carolina Fund preceded the Office of Economic Opportunity, and so when Johnson declared the war on poverty, and they passed the Office of Economic Opportunity or the Economic Opportunity Act. They created a number of community action programs, and they actually use the model that the North Carolina Fund had established in terms of how these community action programs would be set up. And so one was set up in Durham called Operation Breakthrough. And what they did was they broke the city and the county down into three areas. Target Area A, which was Hayti, which I think is where Ruby – you know, where I first ran into Ruby, you know, as a part of Hayti. Then there was a second area, Target Area B, over by where Few Gardens is. I think it's East Durham. And then there was one out in Bragtown in the county. So you had A, B, and C. They needed somebody black to run the Target Area A. And I'm pretty sure that I seem safe enough. I mean, you know, I had a master's degree. I just, you know, and had worked for a year in the Urban League. So yeah. I think I was about 24, 25, something like that when I came here. So they put me in charge of Target Area A. And I had read the Economic Opportunity Act. And one of the things that it said was that you were supposed to have, like, maximum feasible involvement of the poor. And so I actually took that seriously. And I also thought that really that the objective of the war on poverty was to end poverty. So mm-hmm. I actually thought that people wanted to fight a war and they actually wanted to end poverty.
Yeah, but this is significant. Let's not run past this crucial point. If I told you this is the 50th anniversary of something called the North Carolina Fund and its goal was to end poverty, you might assume that this was a program that was going to give money to poor people to help them out of poverty. It was really about organizing people so that they could figure out what was going on in their neighborhoods and get stuff done.
Yeah, you know, but you know what? I always thought it was both. I mean, people always say you shouldn't throw money at poverty. Well, actually, you should. I mean, like one of the ways to end poverty is to give people money. So, I mean, I understand what that all means. But one of the things that I realized is there was really two parts to this. One part was we had to organize people so they could begin to affect change and stand for themselves. But I also try to create jobs. I mean, you know, I don't know if Ruby remembers, but like Ms. Rand and them, for example, became health aides. Mm-hmm. And we tried to figure all of these different ways to take that poverty program budget and make sure it just wasn't those of us who had degrees and stuff that were actually getting jobs and getting money based on the existence of the program. So from my standpoint, it was always two parts. It was the kind of neighborhood councils that Ruby's talking about, you know, we organized those. We organized them in McDougal Terrace. We organized them. And then Ruby, I think, ultimately chaired UOCI, United Organization of Community Improvement. And Ben became the director. Of it.
So. Well, but I wonder what that was like for you first, Ms. Gaddis, at first when somebody says to you, okay, we're living in the city of Durham and we would like you to work within African-American communities to get the ability to make jobs, to get things to happen and change things. You'd lived here a long time. What was your sense of the possibility of that?
Well, it seemed kind of not so true initially, mm-hmm. but once I got involved, I could see there was jobs to be had, but we had to work hard to get them. We had to go through different training programs because Operation Breakthrough itself had job training programs. They had the Neighborhood Youth Corps for the youth, and then they had the New Careers Program for the adults. So people were able to get jobs or go into training programs that would lead to jobs, and that was helpful to us.
And that's worth throwing money at. I mean, you have to create a program, and you have to spend money on that program, which didn't exist before.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, as you know, the way our society is set up, you say we're going to tackle poverty, and then what we do is we create all of these programs where people with degrees and stuff get the jobs. And so, you know, I wasn't going to allow that to happen, you know, under my watch. Let me just put it that way. And so we had to come up with creative ways because initially the budgets did not include a lot of those positions when we first started out. So it was kind of a battle to make that happen.
On the State of Things Today, talking about the 50th anniversary of the North Carolina Fund, Howard Fuller, now a professor of education at Marquette University, Ruby Gaddis, community organizer based in Durham. They were both organizers during the North Carolina Fund and its years here in North Carolina. Bob Korstad's a professor of history and public policy at Duke, and he, along with Jim Lalutis, who's a professor of history at North Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill, wrote To Right These Wrongs. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the North Carolina Fund. Howard Fuller is with us. He was an organizer and part of that program that was established in the 1960s. He's now a professor of education at Marquette University. Ruby Gaddis is a community organizer here in Durham, both organizers with the North Carolina Fund. Bob Korstad is here as well, a professor of public policy at Duke. He wrote a book with Jim Lalutis, who teaches history at Carolina. The book is called To Right These Wrongs, The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. Bob, tell us about the overarching, how creative a program this was, because it did, in fact, become a model for part of Johnson's War on Poverty. What were the foundations of the program itself?
Well, I think from the very beginning, the North Carolina Fund wanted to engage people in poverty in finding the solutions to poverty. Initially, it followed a fairly top-down social welfare model in trying to improve the coordination of services in local communities, and that's what the community action programs did, including Operation Breakthrough. But I think fairly soon, within a couple years, the organizers and having Howard here and organizers in other places really understood that things were not going to change if people weren't mobilized themselves to demand those kind of changes. And it required more than just better coordination. It required the participation of people on electoral, in electoral politics, involved their participation on boards, making decision-making. There was, in addition to money that was out there to fight poverty, there was a lot of money out there for roads and traditional services. And, if you looked around in the black community in Durham, you understood that those people who were citizens and were paying taxes were not getting their equitable share of those kinds of resources, too. So one of the things the fund did was try to get people in positions of power so decisions about the distribution of economic resources could be made by everyone and not just a small group.
Ruby Gaddis, tell us how that worked in the city of Durham. Now you're organized, you've got a mission, there's certainly a need. What happens and what kinds of what effects did you have once you began to organize people?
Once we began to organize, we became aware of actually what was really happening to us and what was happening in the neighborhoods. At that particular time, we had bad streets and everything else, and we had urban renewal coming through. So we were fighting a big war against a lot of stuff, bad housing, bad streets.
That's like 147 coming through, knocking down neighborhoods, pushing, right?
Right,
and,
right around this corner over here.
A couple blocks away, right.
Right around the corner.
So what happens, okay, so you notice that and then you go to City Hall. What form
does it take? Well, we had to, not knowing how to do stuff when Howard came, it was a revelation for us because he geared us in the direction that he thought we should go. Before that time, we had not had that. We had our little community group, but we didn't have direction. We began to go to City Hall and to request things that we thought we needed. We had to learn how to be involved in the voting process. A lot of people were not registered voters, and we worked hard to get stuff like that done. So you could become to feel a part of what was actually happening in your neighborhood and to yourself. And you saw the things that were really wrong, how hard it was to deal with people in public housing if you wanted to try to get in public housing, the kind of conditions people had to put up with just to live in public housing. It was demeaning, and it was just not kind to people. It made you feel like you were less than human.
And part of the challenge, I suspect, Howard, was making sure that people understood this didn't have to be. You didn't have to put up with this.
Yeah, I find what interests. I know Ruby did like organizing, but Ruby was so much more than that. She was a leader, and I really have to make sure that people clearly understand that, because people like me were organizers, but people like Ruby and Ann Atwater and Joyce Starbs and all of these folks who had the courage to like stand up and say that they were not willing to take this type of oppression anymore. And so, I love people like Ruby, and she knows that, but it's because of the spirit that they had and their willingness to confront the powers to be. And that was not a simple task back in Durham, North Carolina, anywhere in North Carolina in the 1960s. And so what the fund really did was to create a way for us to organize people so that they could begin to impact their lives. And so when I left working with Operation Breakthrough and went over to work for the North Carolina Fund, I was able to start doing the kind of organizing in 11 counties around the state that we had started in Durham. And the beauty of the organization that Ruby became the chair of the board of was that the North Carolina Fund, instead of sending money through groups like Operation Breakthrough, there were at least two organizations that they funded, the people, PPOP, People's Program on Poverty up in the eastern part of the state, and UOCI. And so that money then came directly to those organizations, and they were able to control those resources and direct those organizations in ways that had never been heard of before.
UOCI
in North
being
Carolina. United Organization of Community Improvement.
Community Improvement. And right. What was it like for you? Because you did come here you'd started out of Milwaukee, you'd been right. to Chicago, and now you're coming down to a southern city like this.
Right.
What were the challenges for you, and how did you see your job? What was it that you had to do? Because Ruby does give you credit for doing something. So she was courageous, and Ann Atwater and the rest.
Yeah.
But you did something.
Well, my job was to figure out how to use these resources to do what I said initially. How do I use these resources to make sure that people who don't have any resources get some of it? And then how do we use these resources to organize them so that they could impact, as Bob said, it was beyond just the poverty program. It was you got money to pave streets, right? How come you got dirt streets in Haiti? You know, people should not have to live in houses where when it rains, the water is pouring in. You shouldn't have to live like that. Because you live in a housing project, it doesn't mean you give up your rights as a citizen. So if someone is going to evict you, there should be a reason. So we start fighting around these very fundamental things. And my job was to figure out how the system actually worked, right? So that you could figure out what are the points of leverage? when you're trying to get something done. Because it's not enough just to be outside hollering and screaming and this and that. At the end of the day, you actually have to get something done. And so my job was to help people figure out, how are we going to get this done? How do we organize ourselves? What is the most effective way to use the power that we had, which is really people power? How do we use people power to actually make a change? And so that was my responsibility.
Ruby Gaddis, was it difficult for you to organize people? Did people living in those housing developments and on those dirt roads ever believe that their protest was going to mean something?
In the beginning, they didn't. It took some doing. Once you keep working with them and trying to show them the way, then it became a little bit easier, but it was really, really hard in the beginning. They see you out there, but they think you out there just to raise sand or whatever, because you're talking louder than you normally talk. You're saying things that you normally didn't say. But you had to show them what we're doing to try to make things better for the whole city.
Were there forgiving?
Not just for your community, but for everybody.
Were there victories along the way that helped persuade people?
There were some things that helped persuade people. Some of the houses they did try to fix. Now, the streets in the area that I lived, they did not, because, like I said, urban renewal was coming through and they were tearing down. But when the people had to move, they did build two new housing projects, the Cornwallis and Federal Street, even though they were not completed before the people started to move in, but urban renewal was moving them out. They did have somewhere to go. May not have been a place of choice, but they did have somewhere to go. The people who suffered a lot were the people who owned their homes and really had to go and take something else less than what they had. That was not very good. But some of the people did find places to go. That moving like that and the incident with Joyce Thorpe in public housing was helpful because she had a struggle in public housing. And
well, tell us about that.
Howard knows it better than me.
What happened was we organized a group in MacDougal Terrace. And I wanted to say something about what Ruby said, too, is that when they built those housing projects that she just mentioned, one of the big fights that we had was to force them to build sidewalks. Because they built those projects and didn't put sidewalks in. But anyway, so at MacDougal Terrace, what happened was we formed a mother's club. And I mean, my thing was, hey, man, like, who's going to be against mother's club? And I'll tell you who was going to be against mother's club, the housing project, the Carvey Odom. So ultimately what they did was Joyce became the president of the organization, and they tried to evict her. And we ended up actually going all the way to the Supreme Court. And this was the case that changed how housing projects had to act when it came to evicting people. So people don't know this, but the reason why people have to be given a reason for eviction started with us organizing in MacDougal Terrace.
Bob, the North Carolina Fund is experiencing some success. You said learned along the way. It started out as top down. It became much more widespread and broad in its approach. And that, in some ways, became the roots of its undoing.
Yes, I think that the success not only in Durham but in eastern parts of the state and in the West started mobilizing people. They started getting involved in electoral politics. They were down at the city council. They were getting their houses fixed. They were doing all these kinds of things. And I think people in power, had not – that's not something they had anticipated. They were I think, very, very frightened by that. And so it wasn't very long before people started mobilizing against it. I think it really became a way that conservative forces in North Carolina used the war on poverty and what they saw as the kind of changes it was bringing about as a way to really organize a whole new generation of people opposed to those kinds of changes.
Well, we have a clip here of then Representative Jim Gardner, who is speaking out against the fund because it was becoming political.
They were told how to tear down the white supremacists who happened to be in power. They are being told that the only way they can get out of their present poverty conditions is to tear down the organized society and government in their local communities. The poverty workers are telling them.
Here we go. There's Jim Gardner speaking out against the North Carolina Fund, now 50 years old, or we're celebrating its 50th anniversary. But Howard Gardner, I mean, that Howard Fuller, that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, there really is. It's one thing to say, you can't really say, oh, well, I'm opposed to poverty, but I don't want to change the way power works.
Exactly. I mean, I always, when I look at what Gardner was saying, I mean, I remember very clearly, you know, this dude and like where he was coming from and all of that. And Bob reminded me that actually in an interview that I did for the film, A Change Come Knocking, one of the questions I asked is, what were they afraid of? I mean, were they afraid that people were going to get their houses fixed, that people were going to get streets paved, that people might vote? I mean, and so, you know, what people really were afraid of is that this was a threat, as you said, to the power relations. And once people begin to, like, stand up for themselves, and once people reach a point where they're no longer willing to accept the way that things were, then you got a very different situation on your hands. And so at the end of the day, from my perspective, that's what this was all about. Now, you know, I mean, I can go back and say, hey, when I gave the speech up at PPOP, I wish I wouldn't have said people need to get bats. I mean, I was trying to make an analogy between people got baseball bats and you got a little stick. Well, if you go to war and one got a baseball bat and you got a little stick, hell, you're going to get, you know, the person with the baseball bat is going to win most instances. I probably could have found a better analogy to make, but I was just trying to make a point about power, right? So what they would do is seize on those words, and I get it, and then announce that what I'm really out there doing is telling black people to pick up baseball bats, as opposed to what I'm really telling people to do is you got to organize to fight power with power.
Well, it's interesting. You were using the term black power as well.
Yeah, I was.
A scary term, but think it right through. If the power imbalance is the cause of poverty and black people bear the brunt of that, then bringing power to black people is precisely what you need to do.
You just made my argument. that's exactly what my point was. That, you know, if it's about power and you black and you get some of it and you didn't have it before, it's black power. But everybody has to go back to hearing that in 1966 or 1967. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's one thing for us to have this kind of relatively theoretical discussion in 2013. But at that point in history in North Carolina, that was a huge issue.
Well, and so, still today, I mean, if mobilizing people to vote, if making it easier or harder for people to vote is still, it seems to me, can be threatening to people in power.
Well, all we have to do is look at the response of the General Assembly this term to the kind of enormous increase in black voting in North Carolina, and starting in 2008 and continuing not only for the presidential level but for state offices. And so I think that, you know, I think the issues are very much the same as they were in 1967, 68, is that there's a real fear of a real distribution of power in this state and of a real sharing of the resources of the state. And so if you can shrink the state budget down to nothing, then there's very little divide up. If you can keep the electorate under control, then there's not so many people who are having a voice in that. So, you know, one of the things I think is that the we're seeing really right now the culmination of 50 years of the battle against the war on poverty and against the changes that were being made there. And that's been going on. And so I think people who are involved in those issues then and today are going to have to learn some of those lessons, and because the fight is very much the same.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things I would say is that at least back in 1965, whatever it is people want to say, and you have to give Terry Sanford and George Esser and Nathan and people like that credit, right? Because they took a position that we need to do something about poverty. Today, you don't hear anybody talking about we need to confront poverty. I mean, you hear people talking about the middle class, and I'm not opposed to the middle class, but what I'm saying is there isn't a mandate. There isn't a viewpoint today that fighting poverty is something that's important for us to do. And without that type of mandate coming from some of our elected political leaders, it opens the door for people who have a very different view about what America should be like to promote their view. And I don't, I'm not whining about that, because this is sort of how democracy works, right? And the fault that I have is that with those of us who believe that it ought to be different, that we're not organizing effectively to make sure that a different agenda is put forth about what should happen in America.
I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Howard Fuller, a professor of education at Marquette University. Ruby Gaddis, a community organizer based in Durham, both organizers through the North Carolina Fund. Bob Korstad is a professor of history and public policy at Duke. He, along with Jim Lalutis, who teaches history at Carolina, wrote To Right These Wrongs, the North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. There are a lot of activities and events to celebrate the North Carolina Fund and its 50th anniversary. You can check our website, stateofthings.org, and there's a screening of the film and documentary Change Comes Knockin', the North Carolina Fund, at the North Carolina Central, at North Carolina Central's campus this Friday at 7 o'clock. Program events also at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, the history of the Tuscarora War. Stay tuned.